This program contains explicit content and subject matter which may be unsuitable for some listeners. Discretion is advised.
Smart. Sexy. Kinky. Fun.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud with your host, sex educator, author, and filmmaker, Tristan Taramino. It's sex-positive radio like you've never heard before. Tristan talks about sexuality from every angle with leading authors, experts, artists, and icons. From sex education and sexual politics to BDSM and non-monogamy, nothing is off limits. So get ready to open your mind and expand your horizons. This is Sex Out Loud. And now here's your host, Tristan Taramino.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud, everyone. We are live today. It is October 5th. I almost messed that up. And if you want to call and join in the conversation, you can get us at 866-472-5788. 866-472-5788. If you're not listening live, but you want to give us a question or a comment about the show, you can call our 24-hour hotline at 323-SEX-8266, 323-SEX-8266. So the world continues to burn down, and I want to tell all my comrades out there that I love you, and I support you, and I believe you, and I see you. Now we're going to just take a break from the news for a minute and talk about porn. How about that? My guest is actually a returning guest, and we're talking about his new book, so let me tell you about him. Whitney Stroub is director of the Women's and Gender Studies Program and an associate professor of history at Rutgers University, Newark. He is the author of Perversion for Profit, The Politics of Pornography and the Rise of the New Right, and Obscenity Rules, Roth versus United States and the Long Struggle Over Sexual Expression. He's co-editor of the book Porno Chic and the Sex Wars, American Sexual Expression in the 1970s. His work has appeared in such venues as Washington Post, Slate, Salon, Vice, and Temple of Schlock, as well as scholarly journals, including the Journal of the History of Sexuality, Radical History Review, Porn Studies, and American Quarterly. Born in Wisconsin, raised in Alaska, and having attended grad school in California, he now lives in Newark, New Jersey, where he co-directs the Queer Newark Oral History Project and takes many photos of his cats. Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, Whit.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I'm delighted to be back. And thanks for the lovely opening words, because it is very difficult to think about these topics in the context of what's going on in the outside world. So I appreciate
it. Yeah. I mean, I think, though, we do have to take breaks from it because it's so daunting. I mean, you know, there are just times when I have to just put the phone and the computer down for like an hour, you know, just for our own mental health.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So you've got this book. You've been on for your other two books, and you've got this book, which you co-edited with Professor Carolyn Bronstein. Like I said in the opener, it's called Porno Chic and the Sex Wars. It's all about sexual representation in the U.S. in the 1970s. Let me say once again to people out there, this is an academic book that is accessible to everyday sex geeky people, okay? So it's really fun, and there's pictures. So in the introduction, you and Professor Bronstein, actually, you make a great case for how invaluable porn and sexual representation in the 1970s reflected much wider issues going on in the culture. That it wasn't, porn wasn't sort of like hanging out in the corner while everything else was happening sort of socially, politically, economically. So tell me about some of those issues that are happening in the broader context of the culture that then are being addressed in porn.
Sure. This is the era of the sexual revolution, obviously, or the so-called sexual revolution. And a lot of the debates and sort of social battles that are going on around that are really about questions of the parameters of citizenship and the idea of sexual citizenship, who gets included in the body public, what's accepted, what are the boundaries of free speech and free expression, and the boundaries of the legitimate political arena. And, you know, all of that is really being reflected through pornography during this era, which is really central, I think, to both the culture and the politics of the 1970s, and even in just literal, tangible, material ways that are often forgotten now that we access most of our media through the internet. You know, pornography is a visual staple of the city. Every downtown has its movie theaters with big marquees that are very visible. And so this sex culture is literally and materially writ large on the urban landscape and even in smaller towns. And so for all those reasons, it's hyper-visible and it is mainstream culture. It's I think, easy to think of pornography as something marginal or disreputable. But by literally any metric, it wasn't. I mean, we're talking about the era of Deep Throat, the era of Linda Lovelace appearing on, you know, Johnny Carson. And so because of all of that, we thought it was important to really historicize pornography a little more specifically than I think most historians and cultural representations to date have.
Yeah, that's what struck me. I mean, nearly every piece in here is covering territory that hasn't been traversed before. And this is coming from someone who I've read a lot and think I know a lot about the history of porn, right?
Of course. But
why is it that most pieces that, you know, most things that we've even heard about the 70s is the so-called golden age of porn, and we've never sort of dug deeper than that?
Well, I think there's two levels I think I'd respond at. I mean, one is the sort of nerdy academic historian angle. I'm thinking about the question of the archive. You know, how do you research the history of pornography? And as I'm sure you know, it's very difficult because this is not material that's been well-preserved outside of somewhere like the Kinsey Institute, which is not terribly accessible to most people being in Indiana, and a few scattered archives in, you know, New York City and San Francisco. It's not actually that easy, even though it's the fairly recent past. We're talking about, you know, four decades ago. It's difficult to sort of get beyond the surface level with a lot of this history. Filmmakers, studios, magazines, they haven't left their material to archives. And so because of that, I think the representations that circulate most visibly become substitutes for the entirety of pornography. And that's why you so often see it reduced to Deep Throat, Playboy, and Hustler, essentially. And, you know, if people are going to be sort of queer inclusive, maybe Boys in the Sand. And that's about it. I mean, that really becomes then the canon that represents this field that was so much more complicated and diverse. And that's really the sort of opening note that Carolyn and I wanted to strike in the book, sort of suggesting that pornography was richer and deeper and more complicated, sometimes more progressive and sometimes really more problematic and reactionary. But that was kind of the goal, to restore a broader spectrum of pornographies to this history and to put them in a narrative context that's a little more complicated as well. Because I think the two ways we tend to remember 1970s pornography and really the 70s in general are through two sort of reductive lenses. When the historian Mike Davis writes about the history of Los Angeles, he uses the lens of sunshine and noir. You know, Los Angeles is either a beach party with Frankie Avalon or film noir where everybody dies. And I think that's a really useful framework for pornography as well, right? And so either pornography is this prelapsarian era of before AIDS and before this sort of new right reactionary politics of Reagan in the 80s that was utopian, or it's the, you know, dismal misogynist violence that's the sort of narrative the feminist anti-porn movement gives us. And I think, you know, we both agreed, Carolyn and I, that there is some element of truth to both of those. Neither of those is completely wrong, but they're both very reductive and distorting, and the truth is always more complicated. And so it's sort of in that muddy gray zone that we wanted to dwell and sort of pull out these more complicated stories, essentially.
Well, you've succeeded in that. Absolutely. Oh, and we're going to talk about some of the pieces in the book, including yours, which is about the role of New York City, where most porn was being shot at the time. This is sort of like the original Sex and the City, way, way back, folks, in the 70s. So, but we got to take a commercial break. So let's take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about your piece and about more about this book, Porno Chic and the Sex Wars. So stay with us. The Pleasure Chest has all the goods to get and keep you warm and fuzzy this fall. Fall in lust with some cozy cuffs, warming lube, or just up your cosplay with their large selection of lingerie and costumes, right in time for Halloween. Select styles of Halloween apparel, accessories, and lingerie are also 50 to 70% off through October. You're not going to get that deal at other places. And don't forget to get your ass to class for their free weekly workshop series in LA, New York, and Chicago. This month, they're featuring role play, cosplay, and costumery, the OMG spot, and creating meaningful dom-sub dynamics, a three-part series on creating consent-based erotic dynamics. All workshop attendees always receive 15% off their in-store purchases. Plus, bonus, have you heard of the new biofeedback vibrator, Lioness? Lioness has landed and will be presenting Artgasm, an interactive art show featuring orgasm patterns submitted by Lioness vibrator users. It's happening in all the Pleasure Chest locations. If you're not able to make it out to a store, you can always use the coupon code Tristan at checkout on pleasurechest.com for a free massage candle.
Hi everyone, we're Emma and Finn, the hosts of the Normalizing Non-Monogamy podcast. Each Wednesday, we interview people from across the spectrum of non-monogamy to hear and learn from their stories.
So far, we've interviewed a wide variety of guests covering swinging, polyamory, kink, cuckolding, and much more.
Even with all of these guests, we know that there are so many different dynamics and stories to tell that we've only scratched the surface.
So we'd love to have you stop by and give Normalizing Non-Monogamy a listen, and maybe even share your story someday.
Hey everyone, it's Tristan. Have you gotten into virtual reality porn yet? I know lots of people who want to try it, but they just don't know where to go. Well, how about the site voted Best Virtual Reality Site 2018 at the AVN Awards? It's called Badoink VR, and it has the world's best virtual reality porn library with over 240 videos and two new releases added every week. You know I like you to ethically consume your porn, so pay for it and get the good stuff. Start streaming immediately with unlimited downloads compatible with all major VR devices. Oculus, Vive, Gear VR, PSVR, Daydream, and all smartphones. It's easy to use, compatible with all VR headsets, and all subscribers receive free VR goggles when you sign up. Come on, that sounds great. Go to badoinkvr.com, badoinkvr.com/Tristan, and you'll get your first month for just $9.95. You definitely want to check it out.
Streaming live, the leader in internet talk radio, voiceamerica.com.
You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to Tristan@puckerup.com. That's Tristan@puckerup.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. Have you given some love to the Pleasure Chest yet? Have you been over to their website lately? The Pleasure Chest has all the goods to get and keep you warm and fuzzy this fall. Fall in lust with some cozy cuffs, warming lube, or just up your cosplay with their large selection of lingerie and costumes, right in time for Halloween. Select styles of Halloween apparel, accessories, and lingerie are also 50 to 70% off through October. You're not going to get that deal at other places. And don't forget to get your ass to class for their free weekly workshop series in LA, New York, and Chicago. This month, they're featuring role play, cosplay, and costumery, the OMG spot, and creating meaningful dom-sub dynamics, a three-part series on creating consent-based erotic dynamics. All workshop attendees always receive 15% off their in-store purchases. Plus, bonus, have you heard of the new biofeedback vibrator, Lioness? Lioness has landed and will be presenting Artgasm, an interactive art show featuring orgasm patterns submitted by Lioness vibrator users. It's happening in all the Pleasure Chest locations. If you're not able to make it out to a store, you can always use the coupon code Tristan at checkout on pleasurechest.com for a free massage candle. So I'm talking today with Whit Strube, who is the co-editor of Porno Chic and the Sex Wars, which tracks the production and there, you know, 1970s porn, right? All sorts of areas of porn, a lot of historical pieces. Whit, I want to talk about your piece in particular, which is called From Porno Chic to Porno Bleak, Representing the Urban Crisis in 1970s American Pornography. So in your piece, you examine the role of the city as kind of a backdrop and even a character in straight and gay porn of the 1970s, and how it kind of reflects and reproduces constructions of urban space. Let's begin with the heterosexuals, not because they're better, just because let's begin. So this is probably one of the most interesting pieces in the whole book for me, because I learned something. You document basically, you know, some of the most popular heterosexual porn of the time. And in the 1970s, it was pretty violent. I mean, you even go as far to say that McKinnon was writing about violence in porn because there actually was a lot of violence in mass distributed porn. And that may have been a point that's been diluted as we look back and say, oh my God, the anti-porn feminists, they were out of their minds. Why was, like, rape, for example, a central theme in some of this straight porn?
Sure. Yeah, that's a big question, right? You know, I think one thing I wanted to try to do here, because, I mean, I'm glad you mentioned Catherine McKinnon and Andrea Dworkin. I think a lot of us who would identify in whatever capacity as sex-positive feminists, we really don't want to be identified with that tradition, right? We want to distance ourselves from Dworkin, McKinnon, that whole Women Against Pornography brigade for very good reason, right? They had very problematic and often reductive readings. They had a very monolithic view of pornography. I think they were wrong about a lot. But I do think that in that eagerness to distance ourselves from them, we run the risk of not taking sufficiently seriously some of the points they make. And the reality is, it's simply a fact that mainstream heterosexual pornography of the 1970s had a lot of violence against women. And I think as historians, it doesn't behoove us to ignore that or try to dodge it. But I think it's a more productive angle to come at it from, rather than asking why is pornography pathologically misogynist, I think it's a, you know, which it both is and isn't at various points. I think it's another way to frame it is sort of what other discourses does pornography participate in? And I think one of those discourses is that of this 1970s urban crisis, which is a very mainstream conservative discourse of the era. It's what you see in Dirty Harry. It's what you see in Death Wish with Charles Bronson chasing after becoming a vigilante to chase after all these rapists and thieves. And so essentially I wanted to situate pornography not in this sort of reductive one angle question of misogyny, but rather in the larger question of the sort of cultural politics of representation in the 70s, because pornography was a very urban genre. Not entirely, of course. There were science fiction movies and sort of rustic pastoral films, but really urban location shooting did dominate it. And so, you know, I wanted to approach it in a way that allows us to be critical of this misogyny, but to also link it to our other discourses, you know, the discourse of the urban crisis, which itself was a pretty racist narrative of a scary city predominantly inhabited by people of color, and to sort of read its misogyny through that lens, which I think forces us to recognize that it's the problem here is not pornography. It's a larger question of conservative politics and representation. And then the pornography, in this sense, becomes not transgressive or leftist, but part of a conservative discourse, really, of the city as a dangerous place for middle-class white people.
And that, of course, reinforced this idea that all the white people should get out of the city, which leads to white flight, and just characterizing the city as this sort of scary place that is not safe or desirable, but specifically for white heterosexual middle-class people.
Right, right, exactly. I mean, the people who, you know, are sort of pulling the levers of culture, really, and who are the audience that's most desired because of its wealth. And so in all of those ways, I think pornography is colluding with these much larger sort of structures of representation. And hopefully that's a productive way to approach it, because I think we do need to be critical of the misogyny in pornography, but without lapsing into this Dworkin or McKinnon view in which it's all sort of ontologically or fundamentally, you know, misogynistic and flawed. Because there are porn films that push back against that. I mean, Schoolgirl, which I mentioned, from 1971, or, you know, the whole bunch of movies, they also celebrate women's agency and pleasure and desire. It can't just be reduced to this, but I think it's a definite strain that it's dominant within straight porn of the era.
Now, on the other hand, gay porn also represents this so-called decline of the city, but in an entirely different way, where the city is a place of public trysts and debauchery and liberation. So let's talk about all this gay porn that took place in the 70s that had so much to do with being in the city.
Yeah. So, I mean, when you think about what the urban crisis means, you know, from this sort of middle-class straight white perspective, it's really a fear narrative, right? It's about the breakdown of social order. On the other hand, for queer people, social order was already oppressive, right? The social order that we knew was oppressive policing, job and housing discrimination, violence. And so the breakdown of that social order was actually quite liberating for queer people, because there's a newfound freedom. And we see that after Stonewall in 1969, when the tenor of gay and lesbian activism really shifts toward a more radical direction. And a lot of early gay liberation activism is really about claiming space and coming out and demanding visibility and sort of new ways of forming a community, which include sex, right? And so early gay hardcore porn is associated with an entirely different set of politics. And so this newfound breakdown in the social order is one of liberation and regrouping and new communities. And so you really see that in the first wave of gay hardcore in the 1970s, these filmmakers like Wakefield Poole, Fred Halstead, Steve Scott, Jerry Douglas, they're all shooting, sometimes with permits, though generally I think not. So sort of guerrilla filmmaking, and they're putting gay desire out there literally in the public sphere, shooting on subways, shooting in parks, in phone booths, which still exist at the time. And so I think there's something really remarkable about that film scholars have sort of missed because they don't pay a lot of attention to pornography, and porn scholars haven't paid that much attention to because urban history hasn't figured that prominently in porn studies.
And you contrast it so well to then, as porn moves to the San Fernando Valley, it moves literally inside. Both gay porn and straight porn is all of a sudden contained and is more like on sets that are kind of generic, and everyone is all of a sudden no longer attached to kind of any exterior or even a sense of place. Is that how you see it? Like, once everyone moved inside, it was like, where are they?
Right. You know, absolutely. And I think, you know, there's a lot of factors here, right? I mean, one of them is obviously the corporatization of pornography and the sort of factory line production that we see taking place in the 1980s, which does rely on these sort of stable internal sets rather than the more adventurous, you know, sort of underground style of these 1970s outlaw filmmakers. And then part of it is also, I think, about the nature of urban space. When we reach the 1980s, you know, we really see what we would now call neoliberalism taking place, right? The privatization of public space. And I think there's more surveillance and more policing, and it's harder to get away with it. You know, we will see the, you know, guys with camcorders shooting porn, you know, from the 80s through the present. But certainly as an industrial practice, it, you know, there's a huge shift toward interiors. And it changes the texture of pornography, right? I mean, if you watch 80s porn, so much of it is just visually constrained on these sets that, you know, if you're just watching it for the sex, that's one thing. But if you're watching it for these other kind of factors, it kind of cuts a lot of that external world out.
Yeah, I mean, it occurs to me that this is also where the sort of black leather couch and vertical blinds comes in, because that's what I associate with kind of a standard porno thing. Even today is the black leather couch and the vertical blinds, which for some reason, everyone in the San Fernando Valley had or has vertical blinds. Okay. But I digress. Let's take another break. When we come back, we're going to welcome Laura Helen Marks, who has a piece in the book, which I can only describe as totally mind-blowing and fascinating. So before we go, I want to remind you guys that we should start treating our asses as well as we treat every other part of our bodies, and especially when it comes to cleaning it. If you're using dry toilet paper or wet wipes, you're doing it wrong. Switch to Tushy, the modern bidet attachment that cleans all the crap off your butt. It easily attaches to any standard toilet in under 10 minutes and provides a precise stream straight to your butthole. I personally love my Tushy bidet, and I love bidets in general, but I love it also because it's really affordable and accessible. Tushy starts at only $69. Get it? They're being funny. Well, they are kind of funny, actually, because their ads and their social media and everything they do is very cheeky and lighthearted and is very honest and straightforward. There's no kind of weird discreetness about what they're talking about. There's no like strange phrases like cleanly. You know, we're not like pretending we're not shooting water at our genitals. And for a company that's mainstream, that's in the world, I really applaud them for that. You can check it out at HelloTushy.com. Get 10% off your order with the promo code SEXOUTLOUD. Promo code SEXOUTLOUD. Stop wiping and start washing today with Tushy. We'll be right back.
Life on the Swing Set is heading to paradise for the seventh time, and once again, we're taking over Desire Resort Riviera Maya in Cancun, Mexico.
With this year's hosts, me, Cooper, Ginger, Dylan, JV and Shara from Ending the Sexual Dark Age, and author, podcaster, and feminist porn filmmaker Tristan Taramino, our takeover allows us to mold the resort in our geeky, sexy, and inclusive image with orgies, classes about pegging, flogging, and fisting, theme nights, a full dungeon night, naked karaoke, mutual masturbation, and massages.
From November 3rd through the 10th, 2018, this beautiful, all-inclusive resort will be full of sexy swing setters from every letter in the LGBTQA spectrum. Poly, swingers, nudists, kinksters, doms, subs, and those who are just curious about what a week at a sexy resort offers.
We take all the best of the swing set. Our values, our experience, our co-hosts, our community, and we bring it all together with the best resort staff on earth to create a queer, kink, and poly-friendly, consent-aware, and sexy-as-hell experience for everyone who joins us.
To come with us on our Swing Set Takes Desire 2018 trip and hear us podcast about our previous trips, head over to ssdesire.com. We'll be there to welcome you home.
Hey everyone, it's Tristan. Have you gotten into virtual reality porn yet? I know lots of people who want to try it, but they just don't know where to go. Well, how about the site voted Best Virtual Reality Site 2018 at the AVN Awards? It's called Badoink VR, and it has the world's best virtual reality porn library with over 240 videos and two new releases added every week. You know I like you to ethically consume your porn, so pay for it and get the good stuff. Start streaming immediately with unlimited downloads compatible with all major VR devices. Oculus, Vive, Gear VR, PSVR, Daydream, and all smartphones. It's easy to use, compatible with all VR headsets, and all subscribers receive free VR goggles when you sign up. Come on, that sounds great. Go to badoinkvr.com, badoinkvr.com/Tristan, and you'll get your first month for just $9.95. You definitely want to check it out.
The Internet's number one talk station. Number one talk station. VoiceAmerica.com.
You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to Tristan@puckerup.com. That's Tristan@puckerup.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. Oh, I keep forgetting to give you the phone number again. Sorry about that, bad host. 866-472-5788, 866-472-5788 if you want to join the conversation. Hey, I want to tell you what's coming up at the Pleasure Chest. In LA, October 7th, there are two events, Intimate Partner Yoga in the morning and Girl Boner Live Podcast with August McLaughlin in the evening. October 10th, Role Play, Cosplay, and Costumery. In New York City, October 10th, Cock Happy. And then in Chicago, October 10th. Then in New York City, October 11th, Artgasm by Lioness, which is this big art production that's happening in all three stores. It's celebrating the launch of this new, very smart vibrator. And you should check it out. Go to pleasurechest.com to find out about these events and more. We're talking today about the book Porno Chic and the Sex Wars, American Sexual Representation in the 1970s. And someone's going to join our conversation who has a piece in the book. Let me tell you about her. Laura Helen Marks is a professor of practice in English at Tulane University. Her work on pornographic genre, adaptation, and neo-Victorian studies has appeared in Sexualities, Phoebe, Salon, Porn Studies, Feminist Media Histories, and this book, Porno Chic. It's also forthcoming in Cinema Journal. Marks also contributes to the adult film oral history podcast, The Rialto Report. Her book, Alice in Pornoland, Hardcore Encounters with the Victorian Gothic, sounds fascinating, comes out October 15th, right around the corner, with Illinois University Press. Welcome to Sex Out Loud, Laura.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So your piece, I don't even know how to like situate or describe your piece. Because it's essentially a close reading of this film, The Passions of Carol, which is a porn sort of, not parody, but it basically takes A Christmas Carol, the Dickens classic, and transforms it into a porn film where the Scrooge character is actually Carol, a woman. It really blew my mind.
Oh, good.
I mean, how did you come to this? Like, how do you watch this film and go, hey, Dickens, totally, 100%.
It actually happened through, I had to take a Dickens class for my PhD just because it was a requirement. So I thought, well, maybe there's some Dickens porn. And there wasn't that much Dickens porn, but there was this one film. I mean, that was fairly early in my exploration of pornography, especially from the 1970s. And I don't know what I was expecting, but it was not that. It was, I thought it would be something fairly simplistic, and it turned out to be something much more perverse, much more confusing and complicated. So that was kind of my first foray into discovering those sort of weird 1970s movies that were nothing like Deep Throat and Devil and Miss Jones. They were much more unusual in a lot of ways.
This one sounded unusual. Yes. It somehow, though, fits into the landscape of the 1970s in a different way than I was talking with Wit about, in that the female character is the head of a magazine, and it's a takeoff on this actual porn magazine, supposedly for women, with porn pictures of men, that Bob Guccione launched. And there's a whole history of that, by the way, done by Carolyn Bronstein, which is one of the most fascinating pieces in the book. Mm. So she's the head of this magazine that is speaking to a real magazine, and her sort of corporate power is her demise.
Yes.
Which I think is really interesting. Talk more about that.
Yeah. I was very naive when I went into the film. This was some years ago. But I sort of, this actually connects to something that Wit was talking about, this idea that none of us want to be a Dworkin anti-porn feminist. And I used to actually be anti-porn. I grew up in England, where that sentiment is very much, well, thriving. And I kind of thought it was, to be a feminist, you have to be anti-porn. And then when I realized how wrong that was, I kind of went the opposite direction. So I was really going into these films very naively thinking these are going to be 100% sexually liberating and really transgressive and progressive just because there's hardcore sex on screen. And instead, I found something that just simply would not fit that approach. And at the same time, was very challenging in terms of sexual content. So the attitude of the film is very much that this woman is, you know, an evil character. She's Ebenezer Scrooge, but for a 1970s moment in America, in New York City, where her commodification of sex, ironically, is viewed as a corrupting influence. So they essentially sort of translate the original capitalism of Scrooge, his selfishness, and place it onto a woman who owns a sex magazine and exploits her workers sexually, exploits her friends sexually in the past, and eventually becomes what they call a quote-unquote Times Square hooker, which is supposedly the, you know, worst possible conclusion to a woman's life. So there's this real conservative streak running through it that seems to be generated from the Dickens text, those kinds of conservative Dickensian gender norms, but also definitely influenced by maybe a reactionary gesture on the part of Costello, sort of a meditation on that moment in the 1970s.
I mean, I'm thinking of the scene, the present in the film where this married heterosexual couple yes. is having sex in front of the Christmas tree and yes. it's all really fucking wholesome.
Oh yeah.
And how that just
and everything.
Yeah, and how that contrasts to her, who's sort of like the new woman of the 70s, yes. which ultimately apparently would lead everyone to sex work and ruin their lives. Mm-hmm.
Or, yeah.
That's kind of the outcome there.
Sterile sex using a condom.
Which, yes.
You know, that's a very grotesque and dark conclusion. But at the same time, you know, the romantic scene is not the most thrilling, and you don't get the impression, if you've seen any of Sean Costello's other films, it's not like he's invested in romantic sex, let's say. He's very much invested in quite perverse and challenging and risky, edgy representations of sex. So there's this sort of conflict at the heart of the film that is just so fascinating to me, this conservative streak, but accompanied by the thrill of really perverse and sometimes really fun. You know, even when they're showing the Christmas past and it's adults dressed as children, in an oversized room so they look really small. And there's something just so creative and unusual about it that those are the scenes that stand out, you know, even if the romantic scene is sort of a centerpiece.
Yeah, I wanted to ask Whit, I know you've read this piece and so you're familiar with it. One of the things I wondered is the scene where they dress up as children and like one of them gets fucked with the arm of the doll. I mean, it's really, I mean, there's some really crazy shit here. I mean, to me, what was the turning point where that was no longer acceptable? Because you know a lot about the law and the legal struggles. And I'm saying today in 2018, that shit would not fly.
Right, right.
You know, standards and practices, which is a real thing, the lawyers would be like, oh, no, 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 no. No one's acting like a kid and there are no baby dolls.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's actually a really good piece. I want to shout out to Greg Eumanns, one of our contributors, who has a chapter in the book called Suppressing the Revolt of the Perverts. The subtitle is Gay Activist Filmmaking and the Child Pornography Panic of the Late 1970s. And that, and I think Greg really nails it in that piece, that specific moment in the late 1970s when there's a really artificial child pornography panic that leads to new federal legislation against child porn, which then gets upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1982. You know, that's the moment where it all changes. And it's such a complicated moment. And I think Greg does such a beautiful job because his essay is partly about this child pornography panic that emerges right around 1977, 1978. The rest of his essay is not actually about pornography, but about the way so much of that is directed at gay men who, you know, for decades have had this stereotype imposed on them of being child molesters and predators. And so there's so much anxiety, especially in the wake of, say, Anita Bryant's Save Our Children crusade in South Florida in 1977 that targets gay teachers, that he shows how even non-pornographic gay filmmakers internalize this anxiety and shy away from any kind of erotic depiction of children whatsoever, even if it's not sexually explicit. And he really teases out the layers of this panic, right? Because obviously child sexual abuse is a real thing and a very valid social concern. And the real tragedy of this historical moment is that that concern gets hijacked and exploited by reactionary politicians who inflate the numbers and distort the nature of it. I mean, we know that most child molestation happens within the heterosexual family. It's a function of patriarchy, and yet all of the anxiety gets displaced on queer people and single people.
Porn, right? A lot of the anti-porn people say porn leads to child molesting.
Right, absolutely. And we know that child pornography did exist in the 1970s in the U.S., but that especially as pornography becomes a corporate project and all of these companies go above ground, they want nothing to do with child pornography. And there is zero evidence that they're ever involved with child porn because, frankly, it's a legal liability for them. I mean, that's not where the profits lie. So I agree that there's this moment in the 70s, what you're talking about from Passions of Carol, from Laura's essay, that are almost unthinkable today. It's an entirely different regime of sexual legitimacy in a way.
Yeah, so it seems very subversive, that whole children's scene, in the wake of kind of how we think and how we continue to think about children's sexuality, P.S., in this decade, where we're constantly sort of protecting children from sexuality, withholding information, withholding sex education. In some ways, that conservative view has continued to this day.
Absolutely.
Okay, we're going to take another break. When we come back, we're going to hear more about porn in the 1970s, and we're going to talk about Laura's new book coming out because I have no idea what to expect. Do you? Stay with us. More Sex Out Loud when we return. Hey, everyone. It's Tristan. Have you gotten into virtual reality porn yet? I know lots of people who want to try it, but they just don't know where to go. Well, how about the site voted Best Virtual Reality Site 2018 at the AVN Awards? It's called Badoink VR, and it has the world's best virtual reality porn library with over 240 videos and 2 new releases added every week. You know I like you to ethically consume your porn, so pay for it and get the good stuff. Start streaming immediately with unlimited downloads compatible with all major VR devices, Oculus, Vive, Gear VR, PSVR, Daydream, and all smartphones. It's easy to use, compatible with all VR headsets, and all subscribers receive free VR goggles when you sign up. Come on, that sounds great. Go to badoinkvr.com, badoinkvr.com/Tristan, and you'll get your first month for just $9.95. You definitely want to check it out. The Pleasure Chest has all the goods to get and keep you warm and fuzzy this fall. Fall in lust with some cozy cuffs, warming lube, or just up your cosplay with their large selection of lingerie and costumes, right in time for Halloween. Select styles of Halloween apparel, accessories, and lingerie are also 50 to 70% off through October. You're not going to get that deal at other places. And don't forget to get your ass to class for their free weekly workshop series in LA, New York, and Chicago. This month, they're featuring role play, cosplay, and costumery, the OMG spot, and creating meaningful dom-sub dynamics, a 3-part series on creating consent-based erotic dynamics. All workshop attendees always receive 15% off their in-store purchases. Plus, bonus, have you heard of the new biofeedback vibrator, Lioness? Lioness has landed and will be presenting Artgasm, an interactive art show featuring orgasm patterns submitted by Lioness vibrator users. It's happening in all the Pleasure Chest locations. If you're not able to make it out to a store, you can always use the coupon code Tristan at checkout on pleasurechest.com for a free massage candle.
Hi, everyone. We're Emma and Finn, the hosts of the Normalizing Non-Monogamy podcast. Each Wednesday, we interview people from across the spectrum of non-monogamy to hear and learn from their stories.
So far, we've interviewed a wide variety of guests covering swinging, polyamory, kink, cuckolding, and much more.
Even with all of these guests, we know that there are so many different dynamics and stories to tell that we've only scratched the surface.
So we'd love to have you stop by and give Normalizing Non-Monogamy a listen, and maybe even share your story someday.
Stimulating talk
gets those synapses in the brain firing really fast.
All the time. The number one internet talk station where your opinion counts. VoiceAmerica.com.
You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to Tristan at puckerup.com. That's Tristan at puckerup.com. Now back to the show.
Hey everyone, welcome back to Sex Out Loud. I've been telling you about this for months, but I'm going to remind you because it's almost upon us. The Swing Set Takes Desire, where the folks from Life on the Swing Set are hosting their 7th annual trip to Desire Resort in Cancun, Mexico. It is an absolutely sex positive, body positive, consent driven, inclusive event. I had the time of my life last year and I am counting the days till this year. And I found out actually just in a few days ago that there's a few spots open. Which never happens. It usually sells out. And so if you've been thinking about it, if you've been wondering if maybe you want to like try it for a few days, but not the whole week, partial weeks are available. And you can email me at Tristan at puckerup.com. Ask me any questions you want to about this event. I will even get on the phone with you and tell you things. So there are these few spots left. If you've been on the fence, if you don't know, if you want to get the hell out of America, that's a good reason. You can go to ssdesire.com and I hope I see you there. Today, we're talking about the book Porno Chic and the Sex Wars, American Sexual Representation in the 1970s. And I've got on the phone the co-editor, Whit Strube, and Lauren Helen Marks, who contributed to it. So Lauren, let's start with you because you have this book coming out in a couple weeks called Alice in Pornoland. Tell me about it.
Well, it's an academic book based on actually what I wrote for my PhD. So I've been working on this for a very long time. It's about pornographic films from several different decades and genres that adapt Victorian Gothic novels or set the films during the 19th century using Gothic tropes.
So give me an example of those.
Well, so I have a whole chapter on Alice in Wonderland. There's tons of Alice in Wonderland porn.
There is shockingly a lot of Alice in Wonderland
there's
porn.
There's a lot. And yeah, I argue, I mean, part of the simplest reason for that is that the costuming is fairly easy. It's public domain. All of these texts are public domain. For a low budget genre that wants to use some sort of ready to wear narratives to augment the sexual narrative, 19th century texts are going to be really popular because the sort of visual imagery, Dracula is another one. That's the most popular. Alice in Wonderland is fascinating to me because the structure of the book is so much like a porn film. There's so many characters. Every scene, it's Alice wandering through a wonderland, much like a pornographic, you know, pornotopia, as some people call it, where, you know, she'll encounter lots of different characters. It's fairly easy to adapt that to a pornographic setting. But the other chapters I have are on Dorian Gray, which is probably less expected, and Jekyll and Hyde. And then I have, you know, a couple of chapters on adaptations of actual pornographic literature from the 19th century, as well as movies that are set during slavery, which is certainly the most complicated of the films that I explore. But my overall, my argument is essentially that these texts seem to be used by filmmakers as play spaces, particularly for women and queer filmmakers, as ways to explore sexuality, race, gender in a way that feels removed or transformative. So in that Gothic space that is safer to work through some edgier, perhaps even violent fantasies.
and subvert the sort of values of Victorianism, right? Because the Gothic space is sort of the imaginary space.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a place for monsters. And I even sort of talk about the way that the ostracization of sex workers mirrors that sort of, you know, the Gothic monster, the woman who is dissembled in the pornographic scene, the marginal genders and bodies. What's interesting is that the Victorians are seen as this really repressed group, and at the same time, that's where our modern notions of pornography come from. So that it's a very perverse century, and I think that we recognize that. And at the same time, you know, we want to play with this sort of off-limits group of people who we see as being very repressed, and at the same time, we see them as very hypocritical because they're producing massive amounts of pornography. You know, sex work is very popular. We have this new urban space, lots of things going on in private. So that's a very appealing text for pornographers to work with.
So, Whit, why do you think the 1970s was so critical to our understanding of porn today, even?
Well, I think partly because it is a breakthrough decade for visibility, right? I mean, before the 1970s, pornography is really a largely underground cultural phenomenon. And in the 70s, it explodes into this kind of spectacular mainstream visibility. And in a lot of ways, the 70s are the decade where we really reconfigure the American body politic, right? I mean, we normalize being LGBTQ to some extent, and we normalize divorce, and we normalize premarital sex or swinging. And so there's so much cultural negotiation over sexuality going on that pornography really plays a central role in just sort of establishing some of those boundaries. I mean, like you mentioned before with the representations of children, you know, there's a moment where this is sort of permissible and then that moment ends. And then from the 80s on, I mean, we have this relentless right-wing backlash, right? I mean, you know, God knows we don't want to bring up Brett Kavanaugh, but he's the final nail in the coffin of some of the sexual freedom, right? I mean, we have this four-decade-long attack on sexual freedom and liberation coming from the right. And so a lot of us are really attached to that decade for various reasons. I mean, some of them nostalgic and romanticizing, but others because it's this moment where all of this is happening, you know, out in the open without the organized right yet in place. And so in some ways, there's a more honest space for these cultural discussions to some extent.
Well, and we never really had a resurgence of watching porn in theaters, right? I mean, we now primarily watch it on these like little things that are the size of our hands, quite literally, except for those of us who wear glasses or are old. And so there's like that space that existed, which was also a sexual space, a public space, a cruising space, just doesn't happen very often. It's quite rare.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a loss. I mean, those were complicated spaces as well, right? They were fairly gendered. Men tended to dominate them, but women did come in. And that space is hard to imagine today. Not that people don't have public sex, obviously, but it's mediated through things like apps. There's not the same kind of public sphere that crosses all these various lines. You couldn't filter people in the same way in that public sphere. You know, I'm actually talking here from Newark, New Jersey, where we actually had a porn theater that was running through this year, just this summer. The Little Theater in downtown Newark finally closed. And it was a fascinating place. I mean, it really kind of kept that torch burning. And it was fascinating to see in 2018 to, you know, go into this space that's so anachronistic, but was actually still thriving. And it was really sad to see that disappear, because that's not going to be replaced.
And was it little booths with films, or was it also big screen?
No, this was an old school porn theater, 300 wow. seats on the floor, and then a tiny spiral staircase up to an all-male room upstairs with like 12 fold-out chairs and a dark room behind a TV. So it was old school.
That sounds old school. Yeah, I wish that, you know, obviously I go to film festivals and there are like independent events where you can watch it in public, like in community and with other people. But it really has died out like that. I don't know that will ever come back because of the way in which we sort of interact with the world now.
Yeah, absolutely. And also urban gentrification. I mean, it would be impossible to afford today to create that space in some ways on a sustained way.
Yeah. Well, thanks to both of you for being on the show. The book, again, is called Porno Chic and the Sex Wars, American Sexual Representation in the 1970s.
Well, thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
You can find Witt's blog at StroobBlog, but with only one B, .wordpress.com. You can follow Laura on Twitter at Dr. Rambet, DrRambette, and she's Lauren Helen Marks on Facebook. Tune in next Friday, 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern, for another edition of our show. My guest next week will be live with Dr. Holly Richmond. Until then, you can catch me on all the social media at Tristan Taramino. And of course, take some time to talk about sex out loud.
That's a wrap on today's show. Go to voiceamerica.com to listen to this and other episodes on demand or as podcasts. And make sure you come back next Friday night at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 Pacific, for Sex Out Loud with Tristan Taramino on Voice America Variety.